Hello and welcome to episode 88 of the Payers and Players podcast. My name's Robert. I'm here with Scott. We've got a special guest. But before we get to that, if you would take a second to go follow us on Twitter, you can just search up the handle Payers Players. And if you would take a minute to follow, but then also subscribe, we'd really appreciate it. So with that, Scott is going to introduce our guest we're really excited about.
Yeah, sure. We have today's guest is Andrew Goodwin. He's the head tennis coach at Georgia Southern. Before that, he was the assistant coach at Mississippi State, Charlotte, and Tulsa, as well as working, I think, and as well as Michigan, and also worked at USTA Player Development. As a player, he played college tennis at Southern Miss and Alabama, and he grew up in outside of Atlanta. So, with that background, let's welcome Andrew to the show.
Welcome.
Thanks for having me, guys. I'm excited to finally be on. I'm a big fan of what you both are doing, big fan of the interviews, especially recently. I've loved learning from it, and I'm excited to be on the podcast.
Awesome. Well, we're excited to have you on. I know that Robert has probably known you before the podcast even started, so you guys have some history, and that's pretty cool. We'll get into that in a little bit.
Yeah.
But tell us a little bit about your tennis background. I see, like in tennis recruiting, that as a junior player, you were solidly in the top 100 throughout high school. So give us a little bit of background on sort of where you developed your game and how you improved as from a freshman to a senior.
Yeah. So I was really lucky. I grew up in the Atlanta area, just north of it, in Alpharetta, Johns Creek. So I say I was really lucky there because tennis was a really, really popular sport. As soon as I moved to Atlanta when I was 7 years old, I moved to a neighborhood called Medlock Bridge, and our house was maybe 100 yards from the tennis courts, and there are six courts right there. And so right before I moved there, I had been to a tennis camp because my mom was sick of taking care of me in the summer and wanted to kind of get me out of the house because she wanted to just hang out with my sisters. Yeah, and so I got back. I was like, I know some tennis. And I just walked down to the courts every single day, and that kind of developed into I had a basket practice my serve. Then there'd be other people there, and I'd ask to hit. Then, okay, I got my first lesson. I joined a USTA team or an Alta team. Then I played a tournament, and then it really started taking off because in Atlanta, and I know it's a lot more popular now, but they started these like academies or clubs. It was a smaller scale of like what Everett's doing over at Tucker, but I went to Windward Lake Club, and it was just an unbelievable experience. I had just a ton of kids that were around my age, some older, some younger, that wanted to play and just kind of let loose and figure out what I wanted to do with tennis. And the biggest thing was I was extremely lucky to be surrounded by an unbelievable group of coaches, four or five of them that I still keep in touch with to this day. And they really just invested in me. Like they went out of their way to kind of just guide me and help me through different portions of my life. They just helped develop a mindset that they felt like was necessary to be someone successful. And I brought a ton of it into how I coach today, and just more attitude based and how you're working through what you do. But I just felt like I improved because my coaches were really on me as far as how I was treating the people around me, how I was working, regardless of how I was playing, and more how I was carrying myself. And their message with that was, okay, you're always going to max out every day. And if you can consistently do that, you're going to figure it out, whether it was how to handle myself professionally, whether it was treating the officials and tournament directors right after a tournament. And I just got surrounded by a lot of great people. They invested in me. I wanted to give back to them, got pushed every single day. And I think more so just prepared me for the ups and downs of junior tennis and then college tennis and then life after college and getting into coaching. But
Who are coaches there in Atlanta? I know, I'm sure that a lot of those guys are still around, and you're a young guy, so they're probably still there. So
some of them are. One of them, one of the main ones is Bill Anderson. He's out of the junior coach, or he still works a little bit, but he's now head pro at a country club. Cannon Campbell was a massive influence on me. He just, did a ton for me just on and off the court and shaping just how I had to present myself, like the attitude and standards I had to have every day to be a success. He's out of coaching now and living in Florida. The other two, they were really big on me. They're still in coaching. One was Henry Darko. He's the head tennis pro at the Standard Club in Atlanta, which is a very good junior academy. And then Will Wright, he's not at Windward anymore, but he was one of the most influential, and I still talk to him day by day. And he was great. Will saw me at my lowest lows, and he's still talking to me to this day, even when I was a really immature kid that maybe overreacted to a lot of stuff. But yeah, and those two are still in coaching. I talk to all those guys pretty consistently.
Good. So you, after high school, you ended up at Southern Miss. How was your recruiting process, and why did you choose to go to Southern Miss?
Yeah, big thing with Southern Miss is, listen, I wasn't that highly recruited when I was a junior and a senior, and I was looking at different options of, okay, where can I go play right away? I was really competitive. Tennis meant a lot to me, and I wanted to go somewhere where I knew I had a chance to get involved. And so at Southern Miss was one of the teams I reached out to. It was a new coach. I saw they had a very they were losing a lot of seniors for the year, so I knew, okay, maybe they wouldn't be as good. But I was like, okay, there's a chance for me to play. And the thing I liked, too, is I could come in maybe with a new group of guys, and we could just kind of build it from the ground up. And the thing I really liked about my coach there is from the first call, he was just very, very laid back with me, but really built me up. He saw me play maybe once before I committed there, but he was always building me up, just making sure that I knew, like, hey man, you got everything you need to be a success and to do this. I think you got this going well for you, that going well for you. And he just got me to stop thinking so much and just believe in myself. And it was really great for me to go there. And I loved it too, because Southern Miss was a different school from where a lot of my friends were going, or just kind of the norm in Atlanta. So I got to just kind of get away from it all, like whether it was just the expectations that I put on myself or judgment. And I just got to go somewhere, and I got to just go work as hard as I could, and I got to play as hard as I could. And it really, really worked out for me.
Yeah, that sounds good. So anybody who has tennis recruiting, I want to encourage y'all to look up Andrew on tennis recruiting and check out his hair. Because I'm going to say it looks a little different. It looks a little different then than it looks now.
Yeah, they had a picture of like seventh grade at Cary, North Carolina. Of that, when I was playing with my best friends, and I remember it.
Yeah.
Oh man, that's great.
That's good stuff. That's good stuff.
And so, after 2 years at Southern Miss, you transferred to Alabama. Why did you transfer, and where, and why Alabama?
Yeah, I knew when I was in college that I wanted to. I wasn't going to keep playing. College was kind of the end of tennis for me, and I wanted to make sure that I was maxing out. There was a few things that happened within the program beforehand that I was unaware with until I got there, that I felt like was gonna kind of limit what I could do there. And listen, I love my time there. And then it was a lot different then with the transferring, because it wasn't like the portal right now. But I just really wanted to go somewhere where I felt like I could max out my last 2 years in school. And I did not think I would be able to go to a place like Alabama. But I was really fortunate, because we played the same tournaments as them, and they had a new coach, George Husak, who's still there. I still talk to a lot. And the tournaments that they were there, I did really well. And so it was more so word of mouth of who was transferring. And I had a few friends on that team for a lot from Atlanta, and I knew some guys that were coming in, and I thought that would be a really good spot for me, a little closer to home. And I really was a huge fan of George and Ryler, and how they were, just their mindset of what they wanted to do with the team. And yeah, and then I got a chance to go, and I didn't need much talking to. I mean, it's, and I think I set myself up well for it. I think I got a chance to play right from the beginning. It wasn't always easy. It wasn't just a smooth process, and looking back on it, I wish I handled it a little better in certain times, but I think it was great great for me and just my development. And honestly, if I didn't go there, I wouldn't be here. I wouldn't have had the same coaching opportunities as I had right out of college. And that was a big one too. And yeah, it was great.
Yeah, it makes total sense. So tell us, or go ahead, Scott. I think you got a question.
No, go ahead, Robert. I was just agreeing with you.
Yeah, I'm real interested in your transition from a player to a coach. And you know, you mentioned that playing in Alabama was going to be the end of your career, but in reality, tennis has remained your career long term. What made you want to get into coaching, and what are some of the things for young coaches that maybe are in your same spot? They're graduating college and they would like to follow the same path you're in.
Yeah. So I knew I wanted to get into coaching from a young age. In college, it's still, I mean, you're figuring out, okay, what do I actually want to do in life? Like, there's going to come a finish line and I'm actually going to have to make a decision. And it was midway through that I was, okay, yeah, I really do want to coach. Biggest reason of why I wanted to coach was because of the impact my coaches had on me growing up, my junior developmental coaches, and even my college coaches, just because of how much they invested in me, how much they invested in, and just making sure, like, man, how are you doing? Like, what's going on in your life? Whether it's something with my parents going on, whether it's just managing my school, managing relationships with friends back home, the amount they poured into me when I feel like there was nothing really special about me. It's not like I had this insane ability that needed to be untapped, but people really went out of their way, a lot of them, to help give me opportunities to just see what I could do. And I love that. And two, I'm a massive fan of the game. I love it. That I feel like I've learned something new every time I'm out there, but it's more so the coaches that I've had growing up. I thought they were like father-like figures to me. And then, like, seeing that, seeing the impact they had, I was like, man, I want to do that as well. And then two, I was thinking, man, I could spend eight hours on the court a day or something. That sounds unbelievable to me. I don't have to sit in an office. I mean, I do, but back then I was like, I get to spend most of it outside. I love that. And I love just the people, the interactions, and yeah, just learning more every day. So that was big for me. And again, my thought with coaching and someone that's younger and wants to get into coaching is just get involved any way you can. I mean, I know out of college, I got right in with the USTA and helping out with different programs, like as a volunteer, but in my summers, when I wasn't training, I was coaching for my old coaches at a country club. I was coaching at the academies and just figuring out what I could do. Because I think most of coaching is communication and being able to relate to somebody. And you can't just go on a court as a kid and just start telling people what to do. You got to get to know them. You got to figure out what do they do on a daily basis? And okay, is what they're doing on a daily basis, is that going to add up to them getting to their long-term goals? And then too, I think a lot of it, what I got better at it, and I feel like I hopefully still do a good job, is I got to know when to shut up. You know, a lot of times you got to trust your players, whether they're in college or they're younger, to figure it out on their own. Cause my thought is, if I'm just telling them what to do consistently, then I'm not actually going to see what they do under stress. And if I don't know what they're doing under stress, I'm not going to know how to help them and guide them, like show them, hey, this is going to add up or this is not going to add up. But yeah, getting involved and then make sure you're surrounding yourself with the right people that can help build you up. I've gotten really lucky with the coaches I've worked for, like George, like Steiny at Michigan, like Sean Miami, who's at Michigan now. Like Kyle Bailey at Charlotte, like Vince at Tulsa, they've been fantastic for me. I've learned something different from each of them.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that we're learning when we're talking to some of these younger coaches is how much sort of they invested in themselves after college when they started their coaching career. They weren't out there looking to, hey, I got to make money, so I'm going to go teach, you know, the 3-5 women's league so I can, you know, put money in my pocket. They were really about learning as much as they can about the game, how to teach, working with the best coaches. And like you say, you know, Mark Lucero, great example of that. You know, he went out to USTA.
Yeah, I met him.
Yeah, and, yeah. You know, just sort of was like, I'm going to be a sponge on the court. I'm going to absorb everything I can. Trent Tucker mentioned the same thing. Like he would go to coach, you know, highly successful programs, just observe, take notes, and really invest in themselves. And I think that that's, you know, I think that's really helpful in terms of your development as a coach because, you know, you've got to really – learn what works, and you can only do that by observing and by being hands-on with those kind of programs.
Getting trusted to set a direction, like that was one of the things I love most out of college, doing just a small program with the USTA when I was traveling around and working with coaches like Dustin Taylor, mm-hmm. with Sean Miami, Stephen Armitage, Brad Stein, and they like genuinely curious about my opinion. And I'm a 22, 23 year old kid out of college. I'm like, what the hell do I know? But I getting that and just absorbing.
And so what did you, when you say, let's say Brad Stein, for example, you know, one of the top coaches in America, he's coaching Tommy Paul right now. He's coached Jim Courier. How were you able to get that relationship where you could work with somebody like that and observe and learn from him?
Yeah. So it's interesting. I got to know Brad actually my senior year at Alabama. There's a Futures in Birmingham, and he was coming through because he had just accepted the job to work with USTA, and he was going down to the tournament, and he watched us play, and he was starting this new role, and George knew him because they were both from California, and they actually grew up. I think they grew up like a street away from each other, which was pretty crazy. And so Brad introduced himself to the team, and it was crazy because he came up and he was with this USTA role, and the big initiative they had at that moment was, okay, who, like, trying to get more American players to play professionally. And he came up to our practice, and he asked an honest question, like, okay, how many of you guys want to play professionally? And I was the only one that didn't raise my hand, and I felt kind of bad with it, but I just knew what I wanted. And he thought it was strange because, I mean, seeing me work for a few days, and just because I didn't want to play, it didn't mean that I wasn't working. I still hang my hat on that. I think my work ethic, I maxed out because I worked as hard as I could. But I told him, like, yeah, listen, this is the end. I want to get into coaching. And that stuck with him. And throughout the tournament, I talked to him a little bit more. And then throughout my senior year, he reached out to George and said, hey, George, I think we have this program with USTA about, like, helping out young coaches and getting them involved in really high levels. I think Andrew would be a really good candidate for it. And so I got to meet him. I got to meet Stephen Armitage. I went through that whole process, got to know them. It didn't work because I still had some school left, but got through the next summer because they encouraged me to do it, and it really worked out. And so I got to know Brad was one of the coaches that I initially traveled with, and was just kind of hanging around, seeing how he operated. And it was when he was starting out with Mackie McDonald, and whether it was through DC, and he was an awesome, awesome guy for me, whether it was just right out of college, checking in how I was doing, trying to get me to think different ways. And I still talk to him pretty consistently. And I'm just really fortunate with that. Cause like you said, he's one of the best people out there, and he's got a million things to do, a million things on his plate, and he still takes the time to just answer a text or let me ask him questions. And I'm really, really fortunate and lucky in that sense.
That's awesome. He's from everything I've seen, he's a great resource and just a wealth of knowledge, and that he's so accessible is probably speaks to why he is so successful.
Absolutely.
Well, tell us how you became aware of the Georgia Southern position and what attracted you to it. Give us kind of the sales pitch for a player that's thinking about coming to Georgia Southern, and what attracted you as a coach, but also what would attract a player there.
Yeah, so I'll first tell you how I found out about it. The athletic director here I've worked with at a previous institution, I was a really big fan of him just as far as his drive and what he's trying to do with the athletic department as a whole there. I knew there was a head coaching opening there was going to be one throughout the spring, and Jared Benko, he's our athletic director, and he reached out to me about it, saying, hey, at the end of the season, like, this is going to be some of this, is it something you'd be interested in? And the more I talked to him, again, like I said, I'm in coaching because of the people I've been around, the influences I've had, And that's how I've tried to make a lot of my decisions on what I do and who I surround myself with. I want to be around people that are as driven as me, that have similar values to me, and that I know I'm going to learn from. And Jared was, Jared was that, you know, big portion. And big thing for me too is since I've gotten into college coaching, I've wanted to be a head coach. I've wanted to run my own program. I've wanted that freedom, that responsibility to do it, because I think I've learned my most about myself and gotten the most out of myself when I've been allowed, like when I haven't been told what to do and I've been able to just kind of figure it out by myself and kind of trusting my gut. That's the biggest thing for me. And I thought this gave me a perfect opportunity. I had moved around a good amount of times in college coaching, but it was in the idea of it was to be surrounded by the right people and to get myself prepared for a head coaching role. And I thought I was ready for it. And I thought it was just an added bonus here at Georgia Southern because it's in state, it's 3 hours away. And selfishly, I know my mom and my sisters who are both in Atlanta were going to be happy too, but more so it was, I love the direction this athletic department's going. I don't think Jared is satisfied with the direction it's going or where it's at now. I think it's pushing. I love the initiative that, because a big thing was, okay, how am I going to keep learning as a head coach? Is that we're constantly being surrounded by other head coaches, administration, former head coaches, and learning just how to perfect our craft. And I love having a leader like Jared that is hellbent on just making the most, like continuing to push forward. And I feel like we have everything we need here at Georgia Southern. I know it's a small mid-major. We got 26,000 students. We're in a small town. We're about an hour and a half from the beach, 3 hours from Atlanta. The location is great. And the thing I love about it is that if you want to come here and focus on maxing out in your tennis and academics and learn what it really is like to have, to own that impact that a college sports program can have on a community, this is it. You know, you're not just in the middle of a massive city where you're just a small fish in a big pond. Like everybody here, you walk on campus, they know you by first name. You're going to get more support. You're going to get more love than you have anywhere else in the country here. And the thing too that I just love is, I mean, we're going to be a blue collar everyday team that, listen, you want to come compete. You want to come earn a spot from the moment you step on campus. That's what you're going to get. You know, it's not going to be something where you've done this in the past, so you're entitled to this spot in the lineup or this term. It's not like I'm going to reward the guys that are continuously putting in the work, not just doing it to build up a credit, you know. And I think with that, it's going to get just the overall excitement in the program is at an all-time high. I mean, look at what the team did this past year with a lot going on, with a coaching change in the middle of the spring season, getting up to around 50, 60 in the country. And we have the same kind of young team moving forward. I think kids that want to come in here are going to have a better chance. They're going to have a great chance to compete. They're going to be exposed to high level competition. They're going to get a chance to earn it every single day. So, I'm ecstatic about this opportunity. I think we have a ton going for us, and I'm really excited to keep building this thing, moving it forward.
Yeah. Andrew, I watched real quick, Scott, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. I watched your introduction to Coach Goodwin on the university's YouTube channel. I think they put it out on Facebook and Twitter also. It was good. Y'all shot it on court. I thought it was really good. But tell me when I saw it, I thought, man, this is awesome that Andrew has found a place like this, close to the beach, close to Atlanta. With you being so close to Atlanta, obviously recruiting Atlanta players is going to be a priority, but What does the recruiting budget look like if you want to go recruit somebody that's in, you know, England or Scotland or somewhere off across or in even South America? Do you have the recruiting budget just to chase some of those really good players?
Yeah, I can. That was another thing that I saw because I wanted to make sure that if I'm going to be a head coach somewhere that I'm getting the necessary support, not just to do the job, but to be damn good at it. And just looking at what Jared is there and the direction he had like maybe 3-4 years ago, what was going into the team compared to now and compared to the improvements. Okay. I saw that pattern and even so coming in gave me a lot of flexibility to whether it's recruiting, whether it's traveling to all Americans in the fall to give our guys a chance to earn their stripes, you know, and we have those opportunities here, whether it's the travel and all that. And yeah, that was a big reason, another big reason that I decided to come here.
Makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Andrew, I'm curious, you know, this is your first head coaching job. In the interview process, what kind of questions did you get that led them to be comfortable that you're ready to make that jump? And just share some, maybe sort of how that interview process went and what that looked like.
And by the way, I love this question. Scott puts this question in the document. And I saw it. I was like, I cannot wait to hear the answer to this question.
Yeah. Yeah. So it was different in the sense that I had already had a previous relationship with Jared.
Right.
And I'd stayed in touch with him. So I think it was, again, a lot of it was me asking questions to him because I wanted to get a feel for, okay, I knew he was a driven guy, but how he was communicating that to the rest of the athletic department, and because I had seen the direction it was going in. But a lot of what he was doing was, and the questions I got from him or Chris Davis or Brandy, whilst the people really in charge of the search, were more situational about like handling just team stuff. I'm trying to think one of the more specific ones, but a big one for Jared was he was communicating his values and he wanted me to communicate mine. And that's what really, really sold it on me, because he was really confident. He was like, listen, hey, I know, he was really nice. And just like, I know, you know how to coach. I'm not going to micromanage you there, but I need to know what kind of guy, young man you're building in the program. And I thought that was really interesting. So it was more so what I was really valuing, how I was doing it, how I'd go about doing it every single day. And a lot of it, again, I'm pretty honest. I'm not a guy that's going to mince words or try and blow smoke up someone's butt. I don't feel like I have the drill to fix your forehand. I'm not going to be the guy that has the one speech that's going to get you to run through a wall. But I think all this stuff and kind of changing how a guy acts, changing their perspective, getting improvement it's communication, and it's doing it every single day. And that's what I communicated with him, is just the more you know what you're going to get out of me every single day. I'm not going to kind of go up or down based on how this guy's doing or that guy's doing. I'm going to know where we're trying to get to at the end. And I'm going to be constantly assessing, okay, these daily actions adding up to us getting to the end goal.
Yeah.
But
one of the things I'm curious about is the amount of hours a college coach can spend with the players. And you know as well as I do that a lot of these tennis players are multi-hour on court. For example, Tucker, they're there from 6:30 in the morning to 4 in the afternoon. Is it an adjustment for college players when they come to a college campus? And is the rule 20 hours a week? You get 20 hours with them a week?
Yeah, it's certain portions. If you're in your competition season, yes, 20 hours with a coach, whether it's conditioning, weights, or on-court individuals or team practice, yes.
And so do you have a strength and conditioning person, and does that time with the strength and conditioning person count, or is it 20 hours with you?
Yeah, we do have a strength and conditioning staff member that she's in charge of just the men's tennis, does an unbelievable job, worked with them for a few years, and yeah, that counts towards our 20 hours. You know, we do that 3 days a week for about 45 minutes to an hour. And then we do conditioning on top of that. But yeah, it cuts into our hours. But I especially for me, and what I try and do with our guys is, okay, I don't need to be on court 3 straight hours with a kid if they're putting in the right work. You know, right. There's going to be some day like they put in that kind of time with it all added up. But I'm more concerned with, and especially when I first came in here, is making sure they knew, okay, how are we going to train? What is it? What does a good practice look like? What are the priorities when you're an individual? What are the priorities when you're in a team practice, and what really matters? So you're maxing out those hours, because what they're going to see is if you're practicing the right way, like it's freaking tough. But that's at least my opinion on it. I think they get plenty of the hours within. I'm always up front with them and saying, listen, you want more, we'll find a way to make it work for you.
Well, and the reality is, if they want more, they can always, two of them go play a couple sets on their own. I mean, they don't have to have you standing over their shoulder all the time. I just always wonder what that looks like for a lot of the players that are used to playing so many hours, and then they go to a college program and it's cut way down. It sounds to me like they have to be a little bit of self-motivated and self-starters to go make it happen for themselves.
Yeah, and I think you got to be really good with your time management. You know, it's a different setting, and honestly, that's any freshman I've ever worked with, that's what we spent a majority of that first semester really owning is, okay, making sure you have a set plan for when you're studying, when you're getting ready for tennis, and then honestly, like mapping out some time that you just have to shut off because there's a lot going on, and it's just the overall stress of getting to class, going to class, getting to practice, going to class right afterwards, studying, something getting thrown on you, maybe getting jumped at practice or something, having a rough one. It's a lot, but yeah, I think it's a great setup, and it really gets guys to mature and make the most of their time that they're out there.
Right. And what do your practices look like in terms of how many hours on a daily basis? You know, do you have a set practice from, say, you know, between this hour and this hour, everyone's there, and then we're doing privates other times. What does the fall practice schedule look like?
So what I've been doing, at least here, is we always have a team practice for about 2 hours. We flip-flop kind of an early session versus a later session because so we can just spread out and use more courts because we have a bigger team, and that's big for me. The team practices, I like just doing more. Again, we do a lot of boring stuff, unfortunately. Like that's why you're joking, like, man, if the guys ask for more stuff with the coach. I mean, I love spending time with them, but they're probably sick of the consistency stuff I do, and like it's a little boring to them at times. But we do just a lot of basic fundamental stuff, fundamental skills. I feel like people need to learn if they want to be good, and more competition based. In the mornings before practices, I like doing individuals with the guys, usually at least two a week, and that's more specific to them. What I feel like, okay, when watching them compete and when watching them in tournaments, I feel like, okay, this is where I see yourself, like you do this really well. How are we gonna do it more? Okay, this is where I feel like you get exposed. How are we gonna shut that hole down? Really keeping it simple in that sense. And
And
then
do you use
we'll
like video
flip-flop.
analysis, like match reports or things like that, just to highlight those things that you notice in the tournament play?
I mean, not as much the stats, but I'll record matches, and then what I like doing is I'll watch them over and I'll just look at some of their better points. I'll see, okay, is there a pattern between how they're building it, where they're attacking, where they're in the court, what they're using, and just again trying to really simplify it, because I feel like whether, and especially transitioning from juniors to college, I feel like juniors is a lot of learning, okay, how to hit each shot. But a lot of times when they come into college, they're so focused on hitting all those shots instead of competing and really owning who they are on the court. And that's always been a really big goal of mine when I've coached, is just making sure guys are crystal clear on, like, who am I? What do I do best? What am I all about? And a lot of times making sure they know that has nothing to do with how good or bad they're hitting a shot. But I love using the video just because I think it's a visual. Guys can look at it. I do a lot. I'm very big on just a guy's presence. I've said that probably more times than my team would like to hear. But like, showing good moments of it and seeing, okay, like you're doing these little things that builds pressure on your opponent. And imagine how that guy's feeling in this moment. Or look at this decision. You did a great job. Maybe you didn't win this point, but look at what happened 2 points later when the pressure was on again and you did the same decision. So I really enjoy
What?
doing the film work, but
Yeah,
not as much
we
stats.
had Matias on. You know Matias from, he was at Tucker and I's at Tennessee. He told his story of the first day he was at Baylor. He said, you know, he rolled up to practice and he's hitting his serve, and the coach rolls over to him and says, "Hey, go ahead and start hitting your serve for real." And he said, "I am hitting it for real." And the coach couldn't believe it, you know, and Matias didn't get in the lineup. Somebody got hurt. Then he got in the lineup, and I think he won every match the rest of the season or something like that. Have you ever had a player like, and well, and the crazy thing was he could even tell us the scores of the matches. And that was a long time ago. But have you ever had a player that rolled up on campus that you're like, who is this? He's not very good. And then he gets to competing and he's really, really good.
Coaching on the team, and you're looking like, man, how is this guy gonna work out? Or
Say it again. Who was that?
and just figures it out.
Oh, okay.
Trying to let me think. You know, that's a good question. Just kind of surprised, like, got his shot and then really started working his way up.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know how it is in tennis. We all looking for the big serve, big forehand, but not everybody wins that way. And so Matias was a guy who was just really smart, and he could figure out what you were bad at, and then he's going to attack it. So have you ever had a player that just you saw him in the first practice, you thought they're not going to be very good, and then they ended up being really good?
Let me help you out. How about Nuno?
Yeah, that was definitely him. Yeah, that was definitely him.
I bet he was.
There's just something about him, right? There's just something about him that said, yeah, this isn't the thing for you. So now I'm trying to think because it's tough. I love those guys. I love trying to find the people that are a little uglier with what they do and seeing they find a way. Because my thought is, okay, if this guy's ugly, like he has this jacked up grip or he has this hole in his game, but he's still like this, right? He's gotten these results. Okay, there's got to be something there. Right. There's got to be a reason he's up there. And usually that's because of a mentality, because of a work ethic, because of an attitude. And I'm like, man, I freaking eat that up. I love it. I think I had, there are a few really good examples that I think of, like back at Tulsa, there's a kid from Argentina, Ezequiel Santaya, and I mean, he was a junior, but he was a guy that, like, ugly strokes, ugly player, but I thought he brought a good attitude, I thought he worked, and I thought he wanted to get better, and he worked his way from not playing too high his first 2 years to getting up to two in our lineup, ranked like top 70 in the country, beat guys from, like, Pepperdine, Middle Tennessee when they had their best teams, Oklahoma to clinch a match there, really love that. Another one, like, was last year when I was at Tulsa. I thought the kid was great, but his first semester at Tulsa, he couldn't win a match, and he would be hitting balls straight into the ground. Was a Timothy Carlson Seger, and I know I had some tough meetings with him through the fall of just like, hey, we're gonna have to fix some things. And the thing I was most proud of, that kid never dropped his head. He kept working. He didn't care how it looked. And there was a moment where, okay, in the spring, we needed him in doubles, and he knocked it out of the park just because of his attitude and how much he cared about the team. Then there was a day where, okay, we needed him in singles, and he competed his butt off and was unbelievable. And I loved it. And so Vince and I were just like, yeah, we got to keep encouraging this. And so I think he's doing a great job in there. And then there was one kid back when I first started at Michigan that, his name was Connor Johnston, and I know and he had like a two-handed backhand volley that was like this. He couldn't hit a normal one, but the kid was so into the team. He was so into like the presence that Stani was preaching every day that he found a way to be like our number one doubles player. And I remember it came out of nowhere one day just because he had one opportunity because he was bringing his attitude and one guy had to slip out of the lineup. And yeah, it was great. So I wouldn't say I looked at those three and said, oh, no, these guys don't have a chance. But it's like they had their own setbacks and they found a way, you know. But yeah, that's a good question. Yeah, because I love thinking about that stuff. And then, yeah, Nuno, maybe a distant fourth on that list.
Well, and that was what I was going to say. Nuno was probably on the opposite end. I'm sure that when the day he showed up, it was very clear he was special. Tell us a good Nuno story that nobody knows.
I'm undefeated. So with Nuno, I found out quickly, like, so number one thing I did with Nuno was, okay, I know he's really good, but I got to find something that I'm better at than him. So that was, and I found out it's like, you know what? Nuno's not too good with a slice or the volleys. And so every individual and every day I'd play with him, we'd start out working on his chip and I'd play just a baseline game with him where it was all continental grip. And like you come in, you do whatever, but it's getting him creative. And yeah, I never lost to him in that. And so thankfully he graduated before he could get me. I have not played him since, and that's going to stay that way. Another good Nuno story is his doubles partner in college was Strahinja Rakic, who's one of my favorite guys. I was talking to him this past weekend, and when we were working on Strahla, there was something with the serve, and a lot of it was his toss and just because his upper body. So we do a lot of serving from his knees. and Nuno was taking some returns. I just started out with Strahle with the knees, and Strahle actually aced Nuno from his knees. So we always do that to humble Nuno. I think he needs that sometimes. But also something cool, maybe not as funny, but like a really cool, just I think successful people figure it out, is Nuno, before I got there, his first year was not really in the doubles lineup. His second year, he was like a three doubles player, and you watch him, he's not a stereotypical serve and volley, like, I'm going to play doubles this way, that way, and same with his partner Strahle. And they started their junior year not consistently playing, and they worked up to one in the country their junior and senior year. And I think it was not, it was just because they were willing to improve. And like you see Nuno and the attitude he brings every day, I mean, that's why he's successful. It's not because he has a good serve or good backhand, but it's just like every day he was trying to soak something up. He didn't care if he was hitting with someone on the club team, hitting with me, or hitting with Orodini in a set, whacking forehands. He was going to come at you as hard as he could. He was going to try and get better at it. And I mean, even when he was one in the country, didn't mean he had it all figured out. And I thought he was unbelievable, just constantly wanting to get better and bring that. Didn't mean he had it, didn't have his dark days, but I think it's really cool just seeing, okay, it was something he didn't drastically change his game or change what he did, but it was just constant daily work at getting better. And that was, I think, one of his best attributes, apart from just being an ultimate team guy and caring about the people around him.
Yeah. When shifting away. Oh, go ahead, Scott.
Well, I was going to say, I remember, Robert, we went to a Mississippi State match in the spring. I think it was a day when Mississippi State had all their spring sports going at the same day. And so there was a baseball game, a softball game.
It was Super Bowl weekend, probably.
Yeah.
Super
Bowl. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, you know, as Nuno had broken serve and he's sort of jogging to the bench with his hands up, just as he's doing that, I guess someone hit a home run or something like that, and the baseball thing, cheer, the stands go crazy, and he looks up and he throws his hands in the air. He's like, "Let's go baseball!" And so he was all into the baseball team during the changeover. So that was fun.
Well, so yeah. not many stories on him, but what about Gio? So we had Gio on the podcast. I think he was episode 58. You know, there's got to be a story on him because he was entertaining to watch on the court. So I can't imagine what he was like at team dinners and the hotel and all that kind of stuff.
Oh man, Gio, the thing I think most about with Gio is we had this game on his junior year where if you made like a little symbol with your hand and someone looked at it, you got to punch him.
And that's like Gio, my tenure, yeah.
Yeah. And Gio just would do it the entire time. Like in the middle of matches, like he'd celebrate one and he'd put it down. He'd be like, "Oh, I gotcha." Little things like that just slide in that way. Also, yeah, just he brought a different like, kind of laid back sense of humor to that group. And it was that, or just any kind of trend with a video, he'd kind of imitate it. But that's the biggest one. And he really just started a movement with it, with just the little hand symbol. And it got to the point where I remember coaching, I don't know if you guys have had Trevor Fauché on the podcast. He's now at Michigan. I think he'd be a great guy to get on here. But I'm on court with at National Indoors with Fauché, with Florian Broska. And Fauché does something to his ankle. And just like, it's nothing crazy, but he needed to call the trainer out to get it retaped. And so our trainer comes on the court. And I know this isn't a Gio story, but it's a product of Gio. And Fauché just goes up, and the trainer looks him dead in the eye, like really concerned. What's going on? Like, what's going on, Trevor? And Fauché just looks down, does the little symbol. He's like, "Yeah, that's just right here by my hand, right there." And gets our trainer in the middle of a dual match. And I'm just sitting there like, I didn't see that coming. And I'm just like, "What the heck are we doing?" But just those little things. I love those stories. Yeah. And Gio started a movement.
Yeah. That's a special team. I know you guys accomplished some great things in Mississippi State with that group. And we were there for a few of the matches. We were there for the SEC championships in Tuscaloosa. Oh, that was probably great. One of the best college matches ever, when Trevor clinched on court six to win the championship on a double fault. So, you know, you can't ask for a better end than that.
No, it was great. That's some great memories. The thing that sticks out about those teams is number one, and above all else, just that group of dudes on the team. They were an unbelievable group. They'd be successful in anything they want to do with that, the mindset that they had. They're fantastic.
Yeah, great. Well, let's transition into sort of your recruiting there. I know that, your first year there, so things are just getting kicked off. But what's your sort of recruiting pitch to players, say an American player that may not have Georgia Southern on, their radar, but they're the right level, and you want to get them. How do you get them to Statesboro?
Yeah, the first thing is I figure out what they want. Like, what are they wanting out of college? What do they want out of day to day? What are their goals? Because that's the first thing to me, because I feel like if that aligns with kind of the attitude that I have, or that I'm really lucky we have that on our team, guys that are really driven, that want to keep playing, that want a lot of opportunities. I first got to see if that they align with that, because it's my biggest priority. And I talked to a few other coaches that I really respect and that I learned from, just kind of talking through ideas is my biggest priority, especially as a new coach. And my recruits that I bring in now have got to align with what I'm preaching to a T, because if I'm preaching messages to our guys about attitude, about presence, about how we're working with the team, and then I bring in somebody that's maybe not willing to learn, not coachable, and things like that, then what does that look like? It looks like I'm just blowing smoke up the guy's butt. So that's the first thing, is getting them to outline what they really want out of this. And if I feel like there's a good alignment there, I'm more so letting them know, okay, this is how I coach. This is what I'm emphasizing with our guys every single day. These are the opportunities you're gonna have here. And yeah, trying to just outline. I'm more of a guy that I want to outline what it's gonna look like day to day for them. And if I see a guy that's kind of like asking more questions on that I feel like is getting excited and not just kind of going through the motions of seeing, oh, what can you, like, what do I get here? What do I get here? That's not the kind of guy I really want to be around. I want to be around people that want to keep learning, that are driven, and want to invest in the people around them. And I get, hey, I'm not going to get finished products here, but I need to make sure that I have a kid that has the foundation to get there.
So how is then recruiting international players different from US players?
I think the difference is the internationals don't know as much about the entire process and what goes into it. And yeah, they just don't know as much. So you got to explain a lot more about it. And two, I think they're a lot later to the party. They get commitments or they decide later on that they want to go. And then the Americans, it seems like there's a good amount of them that know exactly what they're looking for right from the beginning, and they want to dive in. So those are the big ones that I feel like there. But I recruit both. I'm just looking for the best fit wherever they're from.
And it seems like, for programs that maybe aren't Ohio State or USC, the international players, they don't really know the difference between Ohio State and Ohio. And so it seems like there's an opportunity there to maybe, get in there and make the pitch to the players that otherwise maybe may not listen to you. And so I think that if you look at your roster, you have a lot of international players and, very high level, high 12s, nearly 13s. So that's a, man, that just shows the quality of college tennis is so deep, and there's so many good players out there. It's just a way to sort of level the playing field against the Americans.
Well, Andrew, be honest, how many of the foreign guys that you say an hour from the beach and they go, "I'm in. It's all I needed to hear."
Still waiting, man. Still waiting. No, it's I tell them that, and then again, it's just something I say, man. But
I don't
we'll
blame
see.
you.
I'll let you know. I'm waiting on
Hey,
a few answers right now, but we'll see.
you had me in on an hour from the beach. I'm ready. Let's go.
I know you're ready. Hey, I'd sign you
I'm like
in a
a two
heartbeat.
UTR though. Can I fit in somewhere?
We'll find a spot for you. Just you gotta make sure Everett comes so he can join in. That's a it's a
Gotcha.
package deal. Yeah.
Hey, looking at your roster, it looks like, if I'm reading this right, you have a transfer from San Diego State coming in this year, and he's from the
Yeah, so
West
he's in his
Coast.
second year. I'm sorry, say that again.
He's from the West Coast, so I'm just curious, sort of how you, what's the recruiting pitch to that kid who's, from Oregon, played at San Diego State, and now he's in Georgia Southern. How'd you get him from the West Coast to Georgia?
Well, that's easy. I did not get him.
Okay.
But it's been great talking to him. I mean, he's from the West Coast. He went to San Diego State, and he had connections down south. He knew some people in Atlanta, and he had always heard of Georgia Southern, and he thought it was interesting. He really liked the direction that the team had been going in and felt like, okay, he just wanted to come to a place where he could come work, and he's done a great job with it. And yeah, he's been awesome. I wish I had a better answer for you.
Okay.
But Scott, that's all I got there.
Hey, part of coaching's luck. I mean, a little bit of it's just luck.
Oh my God. Yeah. I know that. I know that better than a lot of people. Yeah.
And so what tournaments will you be sort of recruiting at? Where do you see yourself? You know, I know maybe not now's not the right time, but you know, in the summers, what kind of tournaments will you be attending and trying to recruit from?
I mean, I'll always go to Kalamazoo, and usually now, because I'm a little closer to Quake Courts, but I'm more of someone that I'm gonna follow the guys that I'm talking to, that I'm really interested in, and I'm gonna go where they're playing. You know, I'm gonna invest in them. I'm big in our program, just investing in the people, and I want guys seeing that I'm recruiting. That hey, if you're on our team, I'm gonna invest in you more than anything. So I just want to make sure I get that personal connection as much as I can, and I'll follow them whether they're playing, whether they're practicing, and we'll figure it out, man. So they can just see how much work I'm willing to put in for them.
Yeah. And how do they get on your list? Is that something that you come up with, or is it through players reaching out? How would a player get on your list?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of it is just sending out messages, digging, seeing, okay, maybe this guy's had a few good results. I'm going to reach out to him, see what it's like. I got on a call with him, really like what he said when I asked him this question, really like how he explained the story. I'm going to keep talking to him. I got to invest more. And then a lot of it, like you said, is, okay, former players, coaches I know are calling me and saying, hey, man, this is your kind of guy. I'm going to invest in. I mean, like you said, I know from my connections in Atlanta, I know just about every coach there. So I feel confident that if anyone pops up that isn't going to go to a UGA, I feel like I'm going to know about them and have a good chance there. And then, former players that have played for me and that I always keep in touch with, that they're maybe coaching or trying to help a kid out. They want to send a kid to someone they can trust. And I'm lucky to have good enough relationships with a lot of, or most of my guys that I've worked with in the past. I think they'd trust me with a kid they care about.
Well, you're in a great spot because there's probably no more fertile recruiting area than Atlanta. And you're sort of halfway between Atlanta and Orlando. So within that, you've got so many good recruits that, you know, maybe they're not the biggest fish in that ocean of Atlanta, but they can really play good tennis. So there's a lot of diamonds in the rough there for sure.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Let's talk a little bit about your scheduling. What are you trying to accomplish in the fall season with your team in terms of matches and hidden duels and those kind of things?
Yeah, I mean, I'm more traditional. I mean, I'll play the hidden duels, but I really love the idea of working your way through a tournament, you know, playing other guys that have either just lost first round. You got to build yourself back up against a guy in the same spot, or you're working your way through the main draw, and you got to continue to build your game and build how you're competing against other guys that are in your position, you know. I'm really big on that. I do see the benefit of hidden duels, and I love it. Just because it gives you a dress rehearsal for the team matches. But I don't think I can just do that to help our guys develop. So I like a good mix of it. I prefer the standard tournaments, and also because I think the hidden duel, if there's a few injuries here or there, there's not really a backup plan, and there's not the same accountability like there is in a draw. Like if you pull out, then okay, the other guy moves on and gets to keep playing. But in the fall, I'm trying to throw them in as many different competitive opportunities as I can. And I want to see the buy-in from what we're doing on a daily basis, transitioning it to a pressure situation. And seeing, okay, when do we kind of lose clarity on our identity? When are we doing it really well? And making sure that we're developing good recalls so that when things get really stressful, whether it be in the spring or when they're playing a tournament back home, that they know, okay, hey, I got to go back to this. Like this is what really helps me out.
And do they play any of the UTR PTT tournaments?
They do more so on their own. I haven't been able to do it, like taking a whole team there, just because they miss so much school. But some of the guys have been able to do it. We're really lucky because we're close to Jacksonville. They do a lot of those UTR, not the PTT, but the UTR prize money tournaments over the weekends. So our guys go there, and they recently had one for like Wild Cards of the Futures. And yeah, so we're good with that. I mean, our guys are always looking for opportunities to compete outside of it. And I love that. And that's why I want to keep bringing in guys like that.
And then for this,
I'm looking at your schedule online. It looks like it's only got the fall schedule. When does the spring schedule come out?
Yeah, I'm just waiting to hear back from one more coach, just confirming time and date. But yeah, it'll be out shortly. We're traveling mainly regional. I mean, we're lucky we're in the Sun Belt, so we get 8 conference matches a year. 5 of them are going to be at home, which is awesome. But we're playing schools beginning of the year. We're playing Miami. We're playing FAU. We're playing South Florida. We're playing Clemson.
Wow, that's a great schedule.
Yeah, it's very good. Yeah, we're playing UCF. I feel like we're really lucky. And another thing that's great about this job is regionally, there are a ton of great teams that we can play that can really push us. And just talking to the guys, I mean, we got to dominate kind of our region before we move up to a national, and just making sure there are no steps to different goals.
Well, and as I look at the UTRs on the team, it looks like the top 5 guys are all in the 12s, and then you've got Alex, it looks like, is unprojected, but that's a solid roster.
I think so. Don't sound so surprised there, Robert. But
I'm not surprised. It's just, you know, when folks think about a Sun Belt team and all that, this is a solid roster. I mean, I think there are a lot of Division I Power 5 schools that would be scared to see y'all show up, if I'm honest.
Yeah. No, I think we can do some good things. You know, I'm trying to keep pushing them, and listen, I think the ratings are going to take care of themselves, and you're going to continue to see jumps in them, because I think the guys are putting in a lot of great work. You know, and when you're putting in great work, that confidence builds, and you're doing tough stuff every day, that confidence builds, and more confidence we can be breeding for all of our guys, the better for us.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, hey, Andrew, let's jump into the fast feed. Just going to throw out some questions and just whatever comes to your mind, you know, let's roll with that. So let me start.
All right, sweet.
What's that?
Sweet. This is a rapid fire, you're saying? So just first thing that comes to mind?
Yeah, whatever you want to go with. Which I guess is no different than any other question, but yes, we always do say that. Yeah.
Yeah, do it fast.
So here's the first one. This is sort of a new one to the repertoire. It's tell us 2 things about you. One is true, one is false, and Robert has to guess which one is true.
Oh, jeez. You'll be able to fool me on that easy.
Oh, this can be anything.
Sure. One's true, one's false.
I don't know. I mean, that's a great question.
Why don't we come back to that one at the end, and we'll go through everything else. We'll finish with that one.
I'm trying to think of a good false.
Okay.
False one.
Okay. Robert, go ahead. Mm-hmm.
So, if you could change anything about college tennis, what would you change?
That's a great question too, man. I still think I would love for us to be able to compete more, especially in the fall. Mm-hmm. That'd be mine, you know, giving us an extra date or two throughout the year that we can compete more, like that I can actually help my guys go to, so they're not having to go on their own. You know, that would be a big one for me.
Well, I guess next
more opportunities.
I guess next year with NCAA singles being in the fall, maybe that's along those lines.
Yeah, and I'm interested to see the kind of effects that has on everything, like whether it's the playing date season, how often we can practice as much as we can. But that would be the big one. Okay. For me.
Great. On the road, what's your go-to restaurant?
For the team. Our guys love Olive Garden, man.
All right. We got a trend here. Yeah.
The trend is shifting away from Chipotle, it sounds like.
Chipotle is still up there, but yeah, our guys freak out at Olive Garden. So I walk in anytime we pull into a parking lot, and I look like a king because how they respond.
Well, Everett went for the first time with the Academy. They went to a tournament and he was just shocked at the salad bowl. He's like, Dad, it's not even a bowl. It's like a bathtub of salad they bring to the table.
And it never stops.
And it's unlimited. That's right. Best book about tennis or non-tennis? Your favorite book or something you're reading right now?
Yeah, I got two that I really love. The Score Takes Care of Itself, by Bill Walsh. I love that, and just getting into how he made certain decisions in his program, how he enforced the standards that he wanted. I absolutely love that. I've read that a few times, just got done reading it. And then I love Mindset by Carol Dweck. Just more of a growth versus a fixed mindset, and seeing how every little decision you make and everything that happens to you have a choice of how you view it with your perspective and what you're going to get out of it. And that I love the fact that, hey, you're not a finished product.
For sure. And same question, but with the documentary, one about tennis and one non-tennis.
Documentary.
Yeah.
I mean, I love all those ESPN ones, the 30 for 30s. I love I love all those. I wasn't as big a fan of the Florida one that just came out, the Swamp or whatever, the Swamp Kings. I mean, I love the Michael Jordan one was great. That's probably my favorite one, just because or actually no, I'll take that back. It's the Dream Team. I watched that over the Olympics in 2008, and seeing how that group came together, the kind of impact Kobe had when he came in, and just the different stories of how they were pushing each other and kind of more so dealing with pressure. I love that one. And then the tennis one, I never got into the break point, but I think that's the newer one. But I love the one they did on Andy Murray going through his stuff and all of his injuries and everything.
Yeah, I think that's on a Prime.
Yeah.
That was really good. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, that was a great one.
So then you mentioned it. So who's the GOAT? Jordan, LeBron, Kobe? Who's the GOAT?
Oh man. Yeah, I don't know.
You got to pick one. You got to pick one.
Man, I mean, okay, so I've always been a big LeBron fan going up, and I respect what he did, what he's done, but he's kind of turned me off with how he's handled certain things, like competitively. It's like, dude, you got to act like the biggest guy on the court later on games more, man. And I mean, I didn't really see MJ play that much, but I'll just go him. I'll go safe with MJ. That'll be fine. I mean,
I agree with
Jordan,
it.
people will agree with you on that one.
I agree with you on that. Yeah.
All right, Scott, you want to go with yours?
Yeah, so what is the biggest waste of time on the practice court? What's something when you see guys doing it, you're okay, that's enough, move on.
Short court, short
Yeah.
court. That's what I tell it's like short court in the warm-up, like hitting three balls from the service line. It's like we just spent 10 minutes physically warming up, like go
Right.
fast,
Yeah, I
man.
agree.
But
Yeah,
my guys
yeah.
probably don't like that. I know at Tulsa they didn't like it, but
Yeah. No,
they're
I
just like,
agree with
come
that
on, come
100%.
back.
I'll hit my son a bucket of overheads and he goes to serve and he has to like warm up his arm again. It's like you just hit a bunch of overheads, just serve, okay? Let's go.
All right, so non-negotiables. What would it take to get me kicked out of practice?
Be late and have a bad attitude. Yeah. That's
Makes sense.
if you're making, and by that I mean, like, are you making your day at practice bigger than what the team needs? That's
Yeah.
how I'd say it. With poor body language, poor response to the points, not being
And
willing to work with your
how
team.
often does that happen? Because I mean, every once in a while it has to happen,
Yeah.
you
No,
know?
I mean, it happens. I mean, yeah, and everyone's not perfect, and that's what I try and make with the guys, but you hold them accountable. And I mean, that'll happen from time to time, because I mean, the thing about tennis is, fortunately, like, you can shank three forehands and you can feel like you're this tall. That's a tough thing. And so I'm trying to show our guys again, like, what do you get your confidence from? What's your identity from? It's not how you're hitting, but what are you doing for the people around you? What are you working through? And really Okay, more so just I address it when it happens. Some days guys got to sit out.
Yeah.
Other times it's just whatever's going to get through to the guys, but it's tough. I mean, especially in a team setting, guys haven't come through situations where they're getting held accountable like that. But
yeah,
I think it makes a big difference. It builds themselves. I mean, I had a talk with a kid yesterday. He was getting his butt kicked in a set, and I felt like it was taken away from what he was given to the team and like his view of himself. And I was like, dude, before we even talk about the adjustment you need to make, you need to be you out here and you need to impose yourself, you know, that the guy knows you're here to compete, not your forehand. And it's amazing how often like you bring that, you figure it out. Like that's, I feel like the most successful people, they're not waiting for a good job. They're not waiting for something good to happen to walk around like a badass. They're embodying that consistently.
Yeah, makes sense. All right. So down to the last one, one true, one false. I get to guess.
Okay. One true, one false. It can be about just anything in my life.
Yeah.
Okay. One. God, you're not going to like this. It's not going to be good. It's not going to be good. Just letting you know. I was prepared for everything else on this. Okay. One, I'm 3-5 in my fantasy football league with my friends back home.
Okay.
The other one, let's see. What the heck am I doing? I'm gonna go to McAllister's for lunch right after this before practice.
I'm gonna go with that one. I even though you're a winner, it's hard for me to believe you're 3-5 in your fantasy team, but I'm gonna say that's the true one.
Yeah, unfortunately. Yeah, I'm 3-5. I lost a tough one last night. Jared Goff, I got golfed last night. I got golfed.
Well, I'm gonna tell you. For me, this was a blast. Great to have you on. And next time you're in Tulsa, shoot us a message. We'll go get something to eat. But we're really rooting for you. I'm going to have to get me some gear to wear on the podcast. But we're excited for you. Congratulations on the first head coaching job. And we really wish the best. That a great season.
Yep, for sure.
Absolutely. Yeah, I appreciate you guys. I love what y'all are doing. I learned a lot, like I said, at the beginning of it. And then Robert, been a huge fan of you guys, and especially since meeting your son and seeing what he helped into, seeing him over at Tulsa, he's a light. I can't love his overall attitude towards everything, but huge fan of what you guys do.
Well, we didn't bring it up on the podcast, but Robert and Andrew, you guys have known each other before we even had the podcast, I think. So it's I know it's for you guys, it's a really cool relationship, and I think it's great to see what Andrew's done in terms of his career development and where he's going. He's one of the best young coaches out there, and it's going to be around for a long time, I think.
Yeah, and a quick story. I know we're at the end, but a quick story back, and Scott knows this, but back when – I think it was probably 2017 or 18, Mississippi State was playing at Ole Miss. My wife and I both graduated Ole Miss, so we're Ole Miss fans. But you turned Everett into a Mississippi State fan that day. We were early to the match, and Everett had come off a soccer game, but he had his tennis racket with him. And Andrew invites him on the court, and they just start hitting. And, it was one of those things that even today he says, I can't wait till I graduate. I want to go play wherever Andrew is. So when you got Georgia Southern, he was excited. He was like, all right, that's somewhere I can go.
Great.
I just think the way that you approach even the youngest kids, it makes an impact. Parents notice it. The kids notice it. And so we're excited for you. I hope here in 2.5-3 years that you're still there and he can make his way to Southern Georgia.
Yep, absolutely. We'd love to have him. So, well, cool, guys. Well, I really appreciate it. Thanks again for this. It's been awesome.
All right, folks. Appreciate y'all.
All right, take care, Andrew. All right, bye.
Y'all get one.
Baby, you give me ice and fire. You're giving me wind and rain. You're some kind of butterfly. Baby, you give me. whip up my appetite. Don't leave me high and dry. Oh, I don't wanna jinx it, baby. Can't treat myself better, spine. Don't wanna overthink it, baby. It's just treat. Some kind of butterfly. Baby, you give me midnight. You whip up my appetite. Don't leave me here.